Something had passed between Croker and One Eye about and beyond me. And maybe we all had cause to be concerned. This time, I could not remember much about where I was. Things seemed to be new, first time. Yet some shaking, terrified little creature way back in the night warrens of my mind insisted I was still reliving yesterdays, and the worst of those were yet to come. One Eye said, "I think we'll just take you home now, kid. Your wife will have the cure for what ails you." She might. She was a miracle. Even One Eye, who seems incapable of offering respect to anyone, treated her and spoke to and of her as though he considered her an honored lady. She is, of course. But it is nice to have others confirm that. "Now that's the first thing you've said that I wanted to hear. Lead on, brother." I didn't know the way. I cast a backward glance at Smoke and the covered deceiver. What in the hell? Chapter 31. My in-laws make very little effort to improve anyone's opinion of Nguyen Bao. Mother Gota, in particular, is a major pain in the ass. The old battle axe barely tolerates even me, and that only because the alternative is to lose her daughter entirely. She is very nasty toward the old man. Still, Sari and I raided enough for Croker to insist we swap quarters when her folk showed up last month, in town, slumming from their glamorous swamps. But they won't make it back to paradise if Mother Gota doesn't control her lip in the street. The old man never reacts to her constant complaints. He told me, "I've had 30 years of Goblin and One Eye. One crabby old woman, hurting from gout and arthritis, is nothing." "You did say she's only here for a few weeks, didn't you?" "Right. I did say that. I wondered how those words would taste with soy sauce, or maybe a lot of curry. Now that lady is in the south most of the time, emptying her cornucopia of rage onto the Shadowlands, Croker has had no need for a large apartment. Our old space was little more than a monk cell. There is just room enough for him, lady, when she visits, and a cradle that was given to lady by a man named Ram, who later died trying to protect her and her baby from Narayan Singh. Ram made that cradle himself. Most likely he died because, like almost every man who spends much time around lady, he fell for the wrong woman. Croker gave me his apartment all right, but it came with limitations. I could not turn it into the new home of the Nguyen Bao. Sara and Tai De belonged. Mother Gota and Uncle Doge were welcome for visits. And not one freeloading cousin or nephew more. People who accuse the captain of using his position to feather his nest ought to take a close look at the nest. The Liberator, Mr., by golly, military despot of all the Taglians and their many conquests and dependencies, lives just the way he did back when he was only the company physician and analyst. Also, he moved me to provide me adequate workspace. He sets great store by these annals. My books are not coming out so good. I don't always get stuff down the best way. In his time, when he was on the mark, Croker was really good. I can't help comparing my stuff to his. When he tried to be captain and analyst at the same time, his work suffered. And Lady's writing strikes me as too direct, too curt, and sometimes mildly self-indulgent. Neither was honest all the time, and neither considered trying to be consistent with the other, with their predecessors, or even with their own earlier selves. If you read either one closely and you spot some other slips, neither will admit any screw-up. If Croker says that it is 800 miles from Taglios to Shadowcatch, and Lady calls it 400, who is correct? Both say they are. Lady says the discrepancy is because they grew up in different places and times where different weights and measures were in use. What about character? They for sure see with different eyes there. You will never catch Croker portraying a willow swan who is not bitching about something. Lady makes Swan energetic and rattle-mouthed, and a lot more mellow. And the difference could be that both Croker and Lady know Swan's interest in Lady is not brotherly. And consider how they saw smoke. You wouldn't think they were riding about the same animal. They looked at that traitor so differently. Then there is Mogaba and Blade, both black-hearted traitors too. There is nothing in Croker's annals because he was no longer riding when Blade deserted, but in daily life, constantly, he shows you that he hates Blade with a blue-assed passion, on no rational basis. Meantime, he seems almost willing to forgive Mogaba. Lady sees those two the other way around. She would broil Mogaba right in the same pot with Narayan and probably let Blade go. Blade was another case like Ram and Swan. I guess you don't need to agree on everything to be lovers. They wrote differently, too. Croker mostly kept his annals as he went along, then went back later to fill in after he heard from other sources. He tended to fictionalize his secondary viewpoints, too, so his annals are not always absolutely straightforward history. Lady wrote her entire book after the fact, from memory, while she was laid up waiting to have her baby. Her alternate viewpoint material is mainly second-hand hearsay. I am replacing her more dubious stuff with material I consider more accurate, while I'm in the process of putting all the confused stuff into a uniform format. Lady is not always pleased with my efforts. He understated. My major fault is getting trapped in elaborate digressions. I have trouble leaving things out. I spent some time with the official historians in Taglios' Royal Library, and those guys assured me that the real keys to history are the details. Like, the entire course of history can veer sharply because one man gets dinged by a random arrow during a minor skirmish. My writing room is 15 feet by 22. That gives me space for all my references, for copies of the old annals, and for a large trestle table where I work on several projects at once. And there is an acre of floor space left for Ty Day and Uncle Doge. While I write and study and revise, he and Ty Day clack away with wooden practice swords or squeal and kick and bounce off the walls. Whenever one of them lands in my space, I toss him back. They are amazingly good at what they do. They ought to be with all that practice. But I think they are more likely to hurt each other than any seriously large person, like our old crew guys. I like this job. It beats the hell out of being standard bearer, though I am stuck with that too, still. The standard bearer is always the first guy into a scrape, and he always has one hand tied up keeping a big-ass pole from falling over. I worry about not catching details the way Croker did. And I envy him his naturally sardonic tone. He claims he did good only because he had the time. In those days, the Black Company was just a raggedy-ass gang sneaking around the edge of things, and there wasn't much going on. Nowadays, we are in the deep shit all the time. I don't like that. Neither does the captain. I cannot imagine a man less pleased about having the power that has fallen into his lap, mostly by default. He keeps it and uses it only because he doesn't believe anyone else will take the company where he is convinced that it has to go. I managed to get along for several hours without falling down a well into the past. I wasn't feeling badly. Sari was in an excellent mood despite all her mother could do to ruin our day. I was lost in my work, as comfortable with existence as ever I get. Somebody came to the door. Sari showed the captain into the apartment. Uncle Doge and Tai Day continued clacking away. Croker watched for a minute. "Unusual," he said. He did not sound impressed. "It's not military," I told him. "It's fencing for loners. Yuang Bao are big on lone wolf heroes." Not so the old man. His belief that you need brothers to guard your back amounts to a religious conviction. Yuang Bao fencing technique consists of brief but intense flurries of attack and defense, separated by inactive periods during which the fighters freeze in odd stances, shifting almost imperceptibly as they try to anticipate one another. Uncle Doge is very good. "I'll grant you they're graceful, Mergen. Almost like hutch dancers." By marrying into Sari's clan, I bought into Nguyen Bao fighting styles. No choice, really. Uncle Doge insisted. I am not terribly interested, but I go along to keep the peace, and it is good exercise. "It's all stylized, Captain. Every stance and stroke has its name, which I consider a weakness. Any fighter that's set in his ways ought to be easy meat for an innovator. On the other hand, I did see Uncle Doge deal with real enemies at Dejigori." I changed languages. "Uncle, will you permit my captain to meet Ashwand?" They had taken the measure of one another long enough. Ashwand is Uncle Doge's sword. He calls it his soul. He treats it better than he would any mistress. Uncle Doge disengaged from Tai Day, bowed slightly, departed. In moments he was back with a monster sword. It was 3 feet long. He drew it carefully, presented it to Croker lying along his left forearm, where the steel would not contact moist or oily skin. He bowed slightly as he did so. He wanted us to believe he spoke no Taglian. A vain pretense. I knew him back when he was fluent. Croker knew something about Nguyen Bao customs. He accepted Ashwand with proper care and courtesy, as though deeply honored. Uncle Doge ate that up. Croker grasped the two-hand hilt clumsily. On purpose, I suspect. Uncle Doge darted in to demonstrate the proper grip, the way he does with me during every training session. That old boy is fry. He has 10 years on Croker, but moves more easily than I do, and he possesses remarkable patience. "Fine balance," the captain said in Taglian. It would not surprise me to learn that he had picked up Nguyen Bao, though. He has an easy way with languages. But this had better be superior steel, because the blade was thin and narrow. I told him, "He says it's 400 years old and will cut plate armor. I guarantee it cuts people just fine. I saw him use it more than once during the siege." Croker studied the blade near the sword's hilt. "Yes. Hallmark of Din Luk Duk. Eyes suddenly narrow. Usually stolid expression, shoved aside by surprise. Uncle Doge reclaimed his lover quickly. That Croker might know something about Nguyen Bao swordsmiths apparently troubled him. Croker might not be nearly as stupid as foreigners were supposed to be. Uncle Doge harvested one of his feeble crops of hair, drew it across Ashwan's edge with predictable results. Croker observed, "A man could get cut and never know it." "It happens," I told him. "You wanted something?" Sari brought tea. The old man accepted, even though he doesn't like tea. He watched me watch her, amused. "Whenever Sara is in a room, I have trouble paying attention to anything else. She gets more beautiful every time I see her. I cannot believe my luck. I keep being scared that I will wake up. Cold shivers." "You have a definite prize there, Mergen." Croker had told me so before. He approved of Sari. It was her family that troubled him. "How come you married the whole caboodle?" For that, he shifted to Fossberger. None of the others spoke that northern tongue. "You had to be there. Which is really all you can say about Dejigore. The Nguyen Bao and old crew became alloyed by the living nightmare. Mother Goda materialized. Oh, 4 feet 10 inches of bile. She glared at the captain.
"Aha! The great man himself!"
Her Taglian is an abomination, but she refuses to believe that. Those who have failed to understand her do so on purpose, to mock her. She circled Croker, walking her bow-legged walk. Nearly as wide as she is tall, without being really fat, ugly, waddling that waddle, she looked like a miniature troll. And her own people call her the troll behind her back. And she has the personality. She could test the patience of a stone. Taide and Sara were very late children. I pray my wife will not come to resemble her mother later, in character or physically. Like her grandmother would be fine, though. Cold in here.
"Why so hard you push my Sarah's man, whore, Mr. So High and Mighty Liberator?"
She hawked and spat to one side, the meaning of that no different in Wang Bao than anyone else. She rattled faster and faster. The faster she yacked, the faster she waddled.
"You think maybe he slave me? Warrior not? No time for grandmother to make of me, him always a way to do for you."
She hawked and blank spat again. She was a grandmother, all right. But none were mine, and none were alive anymore. I didn't remind her. No need attracting her attention. An hour earlier, she'd climbed all over me because I was a no-good, bonehead, lackwit layabout who wasted all his time reading and writing. Hardly the sort of thing a grown man does with his time. Nothing ever satisfies Mother Goda. Croker says that is because she hurts all the time. He pretended he could not fathom her broken Taglian. "Yes, it really is lovely weather for this time of year. The agricultural specialists tell me we will make 2 crops this year. Do you think you'll be able to double harvest your rice?" Hawkins spit. Then a lapse into ferocious Nguyen Bao, liberally spiced with imaginative epithets. Not all of them native to her birth tongue. Mother Goda hates being humored or ignored more than she hates everything else. Somebody pounded on my door. Sari was busy doing something somewhere that kept her from being close enough to her mother to become embarrassed. I went. I found One Eye stinking up the hallway. The little wizard asked, "How you doing, kid?" "Here." He shoved a smelly, ragged, grubby bundle of papers into my hands. "The old man here." "What kind of sorcerer are you if you don't know the answer to that?"
"A lazy sorcerer."
I stepped aside. "What's this mess?" I lifted the bundle.
Them papers you've been after me about. My notes and annals.
He ambled over to the captain. I stared down at the mess in my hands. Some of the papers were moldy. Some were water-stained. That was one eye. 4 years late. I hoped the little rat did not hang around. He would shed lice and fleas. He takes a bath only if he gets drunk and falls in a canal. And that damned hat. I am going to burn it someday. One Eye whispered to the captain. The captain whispered back. Mother Goda tried to eavesdrop. They changed to a language she did not know. She sucked in a bushel of air and went to work. One Eye stopped talking and stared at her. This was their first encounter, close up and personal. He grinned. She did not faze him. He was 200 years old. He had had obnoxious, down to a fine art, generations before Mother Goda was born. He gave her a thumbs up, sidled over to me, grinning like a kid who had stubbed his toe in the pot at the end of the rainbow. In Taglian, he asked,
"Want to make a formal introduction here, kid? I love her. She's great. Everything I've ever heard. She's perfect. Give us a kiss here, lover."
Maybe it was because Mother Goda was the only woman in Taglios shorter than him. That was the only time I ever saw my mother-in-law at a loss for words. Ty Day and Uncle Doge seemed taken aback, too. One Eye stalked Mother Goda around the room. Finally, she fled.
"Perfect," One Eye crowed. "She's absolutely perfect. The woman of my dreams? Are you ready, Captain?"
Was he high on something? Yeah. Croker separated himself from his barely tasted tea. "Mergen, I want you to come with us. It's time to teach you some new tricks." I started to shake my head. I don't know why. Sari slipped her arm around me. She was back now, avoiding her mother by being where I was. She felt my reluctance, squeezed my arm. She looked up at me with those gorgeous almond eyes, asking why I was troubled.
"I don't know."
I figured we were going to interrogate the Red Hand Deceiver. That was not work I would enjoy. Uncle Doge astonished me by asking,
"May I accompany you, husband of my niece?"
"Why?" I blurted.
"I wish to inform my curiosity about what it is you people do."
He spoke to me slowly, as though to an idiot. I do suffer from a severe birth defect, by his thinking. I was not born Yuang Bao. At least he does not call me Bone Warrior and Stone Soldier anymore. I never did figure that out. I translated for the old man. He didn't bat an eye. "Sure, Mergen. Why not? But let's get going before we all die of old age."
"What the hell?"
This was the guy who was sure the Yuang Bao were up to no good. I looked at the mass of paper One Eye passed off on me. It smelled of mildew. I would try to make something of it later, if anything could be made of it. Knowing One Eye, it could well be written in a language he no longer remembered. Chapter 32. One Eye's annals were as terrible as I expected, and then some. Water, mold, vermin, and criminal neglect had left most of his recollections irretrievable. One recent memoir, though, did survive except for a page in the middle which was just plain missing. It will serve to illustrate what One Eye considers to be an adequate chronicle. He made up the spellings of most of the place names. I corrected to standard where I could, from the maps, figure out where he had been. In the fall of our third year in Taglios, the captain decided to send the Kusavir regiment to Prebelbed, where the Prabrindra Dra was campaigning against a bevy of minor Shadowlander princes. Me and several company comrades were told to go along to give the new regiment backbone. The traitor Blade was in the region. The regiment proceeded through Ranji and Goja, Jaikur and Kantile, then Bakur, Danjil, and other recently captured towns until, after 2 months, we overtook the prince at Praipurbet. There, half the regiment split off to escort prisoners of war and booty back to the north. The rest of us went west, to Asheron, where Blade caught us by surprise, and we had to barricade the gates and throw a lot of the natives off the wall because they might be spies. With my talent, we were able to hold out, even though the green troops were terrified. In Asheron, we found a large store of wine and whiled away the hours of the siege. After a few weeks, Blade's men began to desert because of the cold and hunger, and he decided to go away. It was a very cold winter. We suffered a great deal, and often had to threaten the natives to get enough food and firewood. The prince kept us moving mostly far from the heavy fighting, because the regiment was not experienced. In Meldermai, three men and I got drunk and missed marching when the regiment moved out. We had to travel almost 100 miles, counting only upon ourselves, in order to catch up. Once we took 4 horses from a local lord after we stayed over the night in his manor. We took his brandy, too. The noble complained to the prince, and we had to give the horses back. We spent a week in Forngal. Then the prince ordered us south to High Nangle, where we were supposed to join the fourth house in trying to drive Blade's bandits into the Ruderal Canyon. But when we got there, we found only 1 old woman in the whole territory, and nothing to eat but rotting cabbages, most of which the peasants had buried in the earth before they fled. Then we went up to Siluray by way of Balichore, and in the forest there we found a tavern, almost like those in the north. While we were drunk, an enemy witch sent an attack of poisonous toads against us. Next day, we had to walk several miles through swamps and melting snow and cold mud in a low place where warm water runs out of the earth and keeps everything from freezing. After a few leagues, we came to the fortress of Trasil, where a regiment recruited from former Shadowlander soldiers were besieging their Trasili cousins. They had been there a long time, so it was difficult to find provisions anywhere nearby, even when we offered to pay. I worked 3 days in the field hospital there, where, because of the cold, they treated many cases of frostbite. The cold killed more soldiers than did the enemy. From Trasil, we marched up to Melopil, with the prince's own guards, and laid siege to the local king's fortress, which stands on an island in the middle of a lake. The lake was frozen. It was very cold, and the ice was very thick, and every time we tried to go forward against the enemy, their missiles came bouncing over the ice. Shadowlanders were slaughtered with great vigor, along with our men, by engines atop the walls, until the garrison inside got the gates closed. Then the Howler came up from Shadowcatch on his flying carpet, and the magics flew around like lightning in a thunderstorm, and we had to run away. Many were captured by the enemy. After 2 weeks passed, orders came to march to join the siege at Rani Orthal. On the way we found some wine, and that ended in disaster, for the natives stole our packs while we slept. Forces gathered from all over, on both sides, and I began to fear a major battle. That would draw the Howler to Rani Orthal. After the city was surrounded, the enemy made several attacks on our breastworks and trenches, which resulted in heavy losses for them. After 2 weeks, when it was starting to show spring, we launched a surprise attack at night, which carried the outer works right up to the stone wall. The soldiers killed everybody, so angry were they, and so frightened to be fighting at night. When they reached the top of the wall, they threw down everyone, even the women and children. Then the Howler came up from Shadowcatch, and with him a small swarm of shadows, and we had to abandon everything we had captured. The Howler and shadows went away when the sun rose, and the Pabrindradra himself went forward to tell the enemy we were going to attack come evening, and this time no mercy would be shown. But the attack never took place, because the enemy king decided to throw in his lot with Taglios. The city gates were opened, and the town given over to the soldiers for one night, but the men were allowed no weapons except their daggers. The soil in those parts is very poor. The crops are not of a delicate nature. They eat much cabbage and roots, and rye is the common grain. When we were in garrison at Thruthalwar for a month, I befriended the landlord's son, a boy of about 11, and found him intelligent but ignorant of both religion and of reading and writing. His father reported that the Shadow Masters have banned all religious practice and all education throughout their empire, and there were rewards out for books, especially older books, which were burned as soon as they were turned in. And likewise, there were rewards for priests who tried to serve their faith, who were also burned as soon as they were turned in. This rule must have pleased Blade very much. After a month in garrison, orders came for the regiment to return to Jaipur, where Lady was gathering an army for a summer campaign in the east. At Jaipur, I left the regiment and traveled north to Taglios, where I was received with great joy by my old companions of the Black Company. The record of that campaign appears to be One Eye's most careful and detailed. The remaining fragments suggest stories much less coherent. Chapter 33. The captive Red Hand Deceiver awaited us in a room guaranteed proof against sorceress espionage. One Eye swore he had woven the spell so well, even Lady in her heyday could not have picked through them to eavesdrop. Croker grumbled. What Lady could do back when doesn't concern me. I'm worried about the Shadow Master now. I'm worried about Soul Catcher now. She's lying low, but she is out there, and she does want to know everything about everything. I'm worried about the Howler now. He wants a big bite of the company.
That's all right,
One Eye insisted. The Dominator himself couldn't bust in here. What do you want to bet? That's exactly what Smoke thought about his spy-proof room. I shuddered. So did One Eye. I had not witnessed Smoke's destruction by the monster that got into his hidden place through a pinhole in his protection. But I had heard. Whatever became of Smoke? I asked. The monster had not killed him. Croker lifted a finger to his lips. Right around the corner. I thought we were going back to the room where Goblin, One Eye, and the old man wakened me from my last seizure. I just assumed they had the Red Hand Strangler there behind the curtain. Not so. We arrived at what seemed to be a different place entirely, and the deceiver was not alone. The Radishadra, sister of the ruling prince, the Prabrindradra, leaned against the wall and stared at the prisoner in a way that suggested she enjoyed a conviction that the Liberator was soft on villains. Small and dark and wrinkled, like most Taglian women who make it past 30, she was one hard woman, and too bright besides. They say the only time she ever lost her composure was the night Lady killed all the senior members of Taglios's various priesthoods, ending religious resistance to her participation in the war effort as a key player. There has been a lot less intrigue since that demonstration. Our allies and employers now seem inclined to leave our destruction to us. If you polled the Taglian nobilities and priesthoods, you would find that most of the upper classes believe the Radishah makes the princely decisions, which is near the truth. Her brother is stronger than is commonly supposed, but he prefers to be off soldiering. Behind the Radishah stood a table. Upon the table lay a man. "Smoke?" I asked. My question was answered. Smoke was still alive, and still in a coma. He had all the muscle tone of a bowl of lard. Behind him was the other side of the curtain, identical to the one I saw when I awakened. Then this was the same room, approached from a different direction. Strange. "Smoke," Croker agreed, and I realized I was being made privy to a major secret. "But this character said anything interesting?" Croker asked the Radishah, cutting me off. She must have been amusing herself with the prisoner. And there must be some reason the captain did not want her paying too much attention to Smoke.
"No, but he will."
The Strangler faked a sneer. "A brave man, but a fool. He, of all people, would know what torture could do." Once again, I got that spine chill. "I know. Let's do it, One Eye. Mergen kept us waiting long enough." The annals. He held it off just so I could get it into the annals. He did not have to bother. I am not a big torture enthusiast. One Eye started humming. He patted the prisoner's cheek.
"You're going to have to help me out here, sweetheart. I'll be as kind as you let me.
What's this thing you stranglers got going here in Taglios?"
One Eye looked to the captain.
"When's Goblin coming back, chief?"
"Get on with it." One Eye did something. The Strangler spasmed against his bonds. His scream, not much more than a breathless squeak. One Eye said,
"But I found him the perfect woman, boss. Ain't that right, kid?"
He leered evilly, bent over the deceiver. That brown raisin of a man wore nothing but a filthy loincloth. So that was why One Eye was so excited about Mother Gota. He wanted to use her as a practical joke on Goblin. I should have been angry. I guess maybe for Sara's sake, but I could work up no indignation. That woman begged for abuse. One Eye crooned.
"You understand your position here, sweetheart? You were with Narayan Singh when we caught you. You have the red hand. Those things tell me you're one of those very special deceivers that the captain really wants."
He indicated Croker. The word for captain he used was Jamadar, which has strong religious connotations to the deceivers. Lady got taken in by them, but she fixed them by marking their top men permanently with the red hand. That made them stand out in the crowd these days. One Eye sucked spit between the stumps of his teeth. Somebody who did not know him might have believed he was thinking. He said, "But I'm a swell guy who hates to see people hurtin'. So I'm gonna give you a chance not to end up like this cockroach over here." He jerked a thumb at Smoke. Fire crackled between the fingers of his other hand. The strangler screamed the kind of scream that rips your nerves out raw and salts their ends. "You can make this last forever, or you can get it over quick. All up to you. Talk to me about what the receivers are up to here in Taglios." He leaned closer, whispered, "I can even fix it, so you can get away." The prisoner gaped for a moment. Sweat ran into his eyes, stung him. He tried to shake it away. "I bet that she'd think that Goblin is just as cute as a bug," One Eye said. "What do you think, kid?" "I think you'd better get on with it," Croker snapped. He was not happy dealing in torture and had no patience left for the games Goblin and One Eye play with one another. "Oh, keep your damn pants on, Chief. This guy ain't going nowhere." "But his friends are up to something." I glanced at Uncle Doge to see what he thought of the bickering. His face was stone. Maybe he didn't understand Taglin anymore. One Eye barked. "You don't like the way I do my job? Fire me and do it yourself." He prodded the prisoner. The deceiver tensed in anticipation. "You! What's up here in Taglios? Where are Narayan and the Daughter of Night?
Help me out here."
I tensed up myself. I felt a big chill. What was it? The prisoner gulped air. Sweat covered his entire body. He could not win. If he knew anything and talked, as he must eventually, his own kind would show him no mercy later. "Sufficient unto the day the evil thereof," Croker told him, sensing his thoughts. My sympathies all lay with the old man. Even if he ever does get his daughter back, he won't find what he is looking for. She has been a deceiver from the day she was born, raised to be the Daughter of Night, who will bring on Kina's Year of the Skulls. Hell, they consecrated her to Kina while she was still in the womb. She would be what they wanted her to be, and that would be a darkness to break her parents' hearts.
"Talk to me, sweetheart. Tell me what I need to know."
One Eye tried to keep it one-on-one, just him and his client. He gave the strangler a moment to reflect. The rest of us watched without expression, maybe a thimbleful of pity among us. This was a Black Rummel man. In strangler terms, generally, that meant he was guilty of more than 30 murders without remorse. Unless he strangled a Black Rummel man and thus gained a claim by the most direct route. Kina is the ultimate deceiver. She enjoys betraying her own on occasion. An argument One Eye did not think to present to our pet deceiver. The strangler screamed again, tried to gurgle something.
"You'll have to speak up,"
One Eye told him.
"I can't tell you. I don't know where they are."
I believed him. Narayan Singh was not staying alive by announcing his itineraries in a world where everybody really is out to get him.
Pete. So just tell us why we have deceivers here in Taglios after all this time.
I wondered why he kept going back to that. The Stranglers had not dared to operate in the city for years. One Eye and the old man must know something. But how? The prisoner screamed.
The Radisha observed,
"The ones we catch are always ignorant."
"Don't matter," Croker said. "I know exactly where Singh is. Or at least where he'll be when he stops running. As long as he doesn't realize that, I know he'll always be right where I want him."
Uncle Doge's eyebrow twitched. Must be getting exciting for him. The Radisha glared, frowned, stared. She liked to believe that hers was the only working brain in the palace. Us Black Company types are just supposed to be hired muscle. You could almost hear the creaks and groans as her mind turned over. How could Croker know something like that?
Where is he?
Right now, he's busting his butt trying to join up with Mogaba. Since we can't stop him, because he's moving as fast as any message we could send after him, let's forget him. I considered offering a word of suggestion about crows. Croker talks to crows, and crows fly faster than even a deceiver can run. I was not paid to think, and I was not there to talk.
Forget him!
The Radisha seemed startled. Just for the moment. Let's find out what his cronies are up to here. One Eye resumed work. I glanced at Uncle Doge, who had stayed out of the way and quite longer than I had thought possible. He noticed my glance. In Yueng Bao, he asked,
"May I question the man?"
"Why?"
"I would test his belief."
"You don't speak Taglian well enough. Little dig there."
"Then translate."
Just for fun, or maybe to nudge Uncle Doge, Croker said, "I don't mind if he does Mergen. He can't do any damage." His remark demonstrated clearly his familiarity with Nguyen Bao dialect. There had to be a message in that, meant for Uncle Doge, particularly when taken with his earlier observation about Ashwan's provenance. What the hell? I was confused, and getting more than a little paranoid myself. Had I come back to my own world after my most recent seizure? In Taglian, as passable as I recalled him having, Uncle Doge shot quick, amiable questions at the deceiver. They were questions of the sort most people answer without thought. We learned that the man had a family, but his wife had died in childbirth. Then he realized he was being manipulated and controlled his tongue. Uncle Doge stamped around like a merry troll, chattering, and winked out much of the prisoner's past, but not once did he get any closer to the facts of any new strangler interest in Taglios, the city. Croker, I noticed, paid more attention to Uncle Doge than he did the prisoner. The captain, of course, lives in the eye of a tornado of paranoia. Croker leaned close to me. In a midnight whisper, he said, "You stay when the others leave." He did not tell me why. He went on to say something to One Eye in a tongue even I did not understand. He spoke at least 20 languages. He had been with the company so long. One Eye probably spoke a bunch more, but shared them with nobody but Goblin.
One-Eye nodded and continued about his business. Pretty soon, the runt wizard began edging Uncle Doge and the Ratishat toward the door. He did it so gently and smoothly that they never complained. Uncle Doge was a guest to begin with, and the Ratishat did have pressing business elsewhere, and One-Eye went about it so unlike his usual abrasive self that he had them thinking it was their own idea. In any event, they left. Croaker went with them, which helped, but he was back in 5 minutes. I told him, "Now I've seen everything. There are no wonders left. I can get out of this chicken outfit and go ahead with my plan to start a turnip ranch," which was only halfway a jest. Whenever the company stops moving, guys begin developing plans. Human nature, I guess. The turnip is unknown here, but I have seen vast tracts of land perfect for cultivating turnips, parsnips, and sugar beets. And Otto and Hagop are not far away, so seed should be available soon. Maybe they will even bring some potatoes. Croaker grinned, told One-Eye, "This weasel isn't going to tell us anything we can use."
"You know what it is, Chief? I'll bet you. He's stalling. He's got something he's trying to hold on to just a little while longer. That's what goes through his head every time I hurt him. He thinks he will endure it just one more time, and then just one more time."
"Let him get thirsty for a while." Croaker shoved the deceiver's chair over against the wall, tossed a piece of ragged linen over him as though he was discarded furniture. "Mergen, listen up. Time is getting tight. Things are going to start happening. I need you in the first rank, healed or not."
"I don't like the sound of that."
He didn't feel like joking. "We've discovered some interesting things about smoke." Suddenly, he was speaking the Jewel City's dialect, unknown outside the company here, unless Mogaba was lurking around. "We stalled because of your lapses, and what they might signify, but we have to move on. It's time to take chances. There are some new tricks you need to learn, old dog."
"You trying to scare me?"
"No. This is important. Pay attention. I don't have time to work smoke anymore. Neither does One-Eye. The arsenal is eating up all his time. And I don't trust anybody else but you to help with this.
You're going too fast for me.
Pay attention. And by that, I mean keep your ears and eyes open and your mouth shut. We may not get much time. The Ratishat could decide to come back and torment the deceiver again. She likes that sort of thing." He told One-Eye,
"Remind me to see if we can't get Cordy Mather assigned here permanently. She doesn't get underfoot when he's around. He's supposed to be back in town soon, if he's not here already."
"That there is my intelligence, Chief," Croaker told me, pointing at One-Eye and shaking his head. "Blind in one eye and can't see out the other." I glanced at the cloth-covered villain. He had begun snoring. A good soldier seizing his rest when it was available. Chapter 34. Hours passed. Croaker left, then returned. Now he slapped me on the back.
"See how easy it is, Mergen? Ever seen such a big... See how easy it is, Mergen? Ever seen such a big trick that was this simple?"
"Nothing to it," I agreed. "Like falling off a log. Or like falling into a bottomless pit, maybe. Which I have had enough involuntary practice doing. Nothing is ever as simple as somebody tells you it is going to be.
I knew this would be no exception when I tried it myself, amazing as it was. At least now I understand how you got so damned spooky, knowing things you shouldn't.
Croker laughed. Go ahead. Showing off his astonishing discovery had put him into a grand mood. Try it.
I gave him a look he chose to interpret as my not really understanding what he meant. Nothing to it, like falling off a log. Maybe. Only one eye is not a very good teacher.
Do what one eye showed you. Decide what you want to see. Tell Smoke, but be damned careful how you do that. You have to be precise. Precision is everything. Ambiguity is deadly.
That's the way the magic goes in every story I ever heard, Captain. The ambiguity screw you every time.
You think so?
You might be right. I must have touched a nerve. He became thoughtful suddenly.
Go ahead.
I was reluctant.
This whole thing is too much like what keeps happening to me when I fall down the rabbit hole to Dejigore.
Could Smoke be doing that to me somehow?
Croker shook his head. No way. It's not the same. Go ahead, I insist. You're wasting time. Go look at something you always wanted to know about for the Annals. We'll be right here to cover you.
How about I go look for Otto and Hagop? I know where they are. They just passed the first cataract. They'll be here in a few days. Try something else.
Hagop and Otto had spent the last 3 years traveling back north with a Taglian delegation and letters from Lady to those she had left behind. Their mission was to learn anything possibly known there about the Shadow Master, Long Shadow. One of the dead Shadow Masters, Storm Shadow, had turned out to be a refugee from Lady's old empire, Stormbringer, previously thought dead. And two other big and nasty sorcerers, long believed perished, also have turned up and remain burrs under our saddles. The Howler and Lady's mad sister, Soulcatcher. And there was Shapeshifter too, but we took care of him. That Otto and Hagop managed to survive so incredible a journey was to me a major miracle. But Otto and Hagop are blessed.
I expect they'll have whole new collections of scars to talk about.
Croker nodded.
He seemed a little grim now, a little anxious. Time to get on with my training.
An unexplained tragedy of the past caught my imagination. There had been some grotesque, horrible, senseless killings in a village called Bond that never got connected with anyone or anything to my recollection. I was sure they had to be important somehow and was baffled that, even today, the slaughter remained unsolved and unresolved. I gripped Smoke's hand, blanked my mind, spoke careful instructions in a whisper. And away I went, out of my body, so suddenly I almost panicked. For a moment I thought I recalled doing all this before. But I could not remember what was going to happen. The old man was right. This was not the same as my unwanted plunges into my own past. In this nightmare, I was aware and in control. I was a disembodied vision racing toward Bond, but my mission remained clear in my mind. That was a big distinction. When I floated over Dejigore, I lacked identity and control till I merged with myself of the past. Then, I forgot the future. Bond is a hamlet on the south bank of the River Main, facing the Vedna Bota Ford. For centuries, the Main has been the traditional boundary of the Taglian heartland.
The peoples who live below the river share the languages and religions of Taglios, but are considered only tributary cousins by the Taglians themselves. The non-agrarian part of Bond's economy revolved around a small remount station for the military courier post. A minimal garrison of Shadar cavalrymen managed the station and kept watch on forward traffic. Bond was the kind of duty soldiers dream about. There were no officers and very little work. The river was low enough to ford only about 3 months a year. But the garrison got paid all year round. Smokes's soul slipped back to that long-ago disaster. I stayed with him, carrying a load of fear despite all of Croker's reassurances. It was very dark that night in that Bond gone by. Horror stalked out of the night, and those nightmares where men are more often prey than predator. A monster padded through the hamlet, headed toward the army stable. I watched from a place where I could offer no warning. One solitary soldier had the watch. He was nodding. Neither he nor the horses sensed their danger. The latch rose inside the stable door. No animal mind knew enough to pull a string. The soldier started awake just in time to see a dark shape with scarlet eyes hurtling toward him. The monster fed, then padded into the night. It killed again. Screams wakened the garrison. The soldiers seized their arms. The monster, like an oversized black panther, loped to the river, swam to the northern shore. I knew something now. The killer was a shapeshifter. The acolyte of the sorcerer shapeshifter, whom we had destroyed the night we captured Dejagore. She got away, trapped in the animal shape. Why just this one incident in more than 4 years? I wanted to follow the panther, to discover what had become of it, but Smoke could not be coaxed to go. The comatose wizard had no will or ego I could detect, but apparently he did have limits or constraints. Funny, though. I felt no real emotion until I returned to the reality of the palace. Then it hit me in a wave, hard, leaving me breathless. I asked, "Is whatever I see out there true?"
"We haven't seen any evidence otherwise."
Croker's caution meant he had reservations. Always suspicious, our captain.
"You look bad. You see something nasty?"
"Very." One eye was gone, and the strangler had fouled himself. I wrinkled my nose. "I can use Smoke to look anywhere."
"Almost. Some places he can't or won't go, and he can't go back to any time before he went into the coma. You can catch the annals up now, eyewitness style, if you will. But always remember to be careful about pointing him right."
Wow. The implications had begun to sink in. This is worth more than a veteran legion. Now I knew how we had pulled off some really startling coups lately. If you can perch on your enemy's shoulder, nothing is going to go his way. It's worth a lot more. And that's why you're going to keep your mouth shut, even around your dearly beloved.
Does the Radisha know?
No. You, me, and One Eye, maybe Goblin, if One Eye just had to share it with somebody. And that's the limit. One Eye found it by accident when he was trying to pull Smoke out of his coma. Smoke has been to Overlook. He's walked around inside. He's actually met Long Shadow. We wanted to ask him some questions. We decided they could wait. You don't tell anybody. Understand?
There you go, being suspicious of my in-laws again. I'd cut your throat. I get the message, boss.
Don't brag it up to my deceiver drinking buddies.
Shit. This could win us the war.
It won't hurt. As long as it's secret. I have business with the Radisha.
Practice using him.
Don't worry about working him too hard. You can't.
He squeezed my shoulder, left the room with a stride that seemed both determined and fatalistic.
Must be facing another budgetary conference. Depending on whether you were the Liberator or the Radisha, the military either never had enough or always wanted too much.
So, there was just me and one halfway-dead wizard and one stinky strangler under a linen rag. I considered using smoke to find out what Stinky's buddies were up to in Taglios, but reasoned that the captain would not have had him interrogated if Smoke had been able to provide useful answers. Maybe you not only had to be precise in your instructions, you had to have some idea what you were seeking.
You could not find your own elbow if you could not guess what directions to give to get you there. The point,
old Smoke was a miracle, but he had major limitations. And most of those would exist right inside our own heads. We would become the beneficiaries or victims of our own imaginations. What should I go see then? I was excited now. I was up for an adventure. So what the hell? Why not go straight for the biggie? How about taking a peek at the Shadow Master himself?
Long Shadow. Number one boy on the Black Company shit list.
Chapter 35.
Long Shadow could have pranced right out of my fantasies. He was a deadly freak. He was tall and thin and twitchy, given to flights of rage and subject to sudden spells resembling malarial shakes. He wore a sort of loose, black, floor-length chemise that concealed a deathly gauntness. He ate infrequently and then only picked. He could have been a famine victim. Threads of silver and gold and glistening black, embroidered or woven into his robe, protected him with dozens of static sorceries. At first blush, he seemed 100 times more paranoid than Croker. But he did have reason. There was just a whole world full of folks who wanted to roast his skinny ass, and he had no friends closer than Mogava and Blade. The Howler was not a friend. He was an ally. One of Long Shadow's obsessions was the Black Company. I did not understand. The kind of enemies we were should not have troubled him at all. We were no world killers. His face, which he kept masked except when he was alone, was skull-like. His waxy, pallid features were frozen in a permanent expression of fear. There was no guessing his birth race. His eyes were a washed-out gray, with splotches of pink around the edges. But I don't think he was an albino. I exploited Smokes' ability, fluttered about through time to find out all the interesting stuff fast. I did not catch Long Shadow completely out of costume once. The man did not bathe. He did not change clothing. He wore gloves all the time. The last of the four Shadow Masters, now the Shadow Master, he was the unquestioned tyrant of the city Shadowcatch, and a demigod within his fortress overlook. His slightest whim could set 100 terrors and 10,000 men scrambling to appease him. And still, he was a prisoner doing life
without hope of parole. Overlook is, but for one, the southernmost work of man. I tried pushing past that fortress. Somewhere in the mists beyond Overlook is Katovar, toward which we have marched for years. Just a glimpse would be marvelous. Smoke refused to go any farther south. Smoke had been crazy about Katovar while he was still healthy. Katovar was the reason he deserted the Radishah and Prabhindradra years ago. His fear of Katovar must have impressed itself upon his very flesh and soul. Long Shadow's fortress was gargantuan. Overlook dwarfed every human construction I have ever seen, including the lady's monstrous tower at Charm. Already 2 decades in the building, Overlook's construction had become the main industry of Shadowcatch. The city that was called Kialune before the coming of the Shadow Masters. Kialune meant Shadow Gate in the local dialect. The builders worked day and night. They knew no holidays. Long Shadow was determined that his fortress be complete before his enemies overtook him. If he won that race, he believed he would become master of the world. No power of heaven or hell or earth ought to be able to reach him inside a finished Overlook. Not even the darkness that brushed him every night with its terror. Overlook's outer walls reared 100 or more feet high. Where are you going to find a ladder that tall? Brass and silver and gold characters shone on the steel plates that sheathed the rude stone of the wall face. Battalions of workmen did nothing but keep those runes polished and gleaming. I could not read them, but I knew they anchored massive defensive spells. Long Shadow spellwork overlaid everything that was part of Overlook, layer upon layer. If he was allowed enough time, every exterior surface of the fortress would be hidden beneath and behind impenetrable tangles of sorceries. Once the sun went down, Overlook became a conflagration of light. Bright crystal chambers topped every tower, making the place seem a fortress of lighthouses. The crystal domes were places whence Long Shadow could observe safe from his terrace. The overpowering lights left no places for shadows to hide. He feared that which he mastered far more than anything else in the world. Even the Black Company, for him, was a buzzing mosquito of a nuisance. Even unfinished Overlook daunted me thoroughly. What sort of hubris-driven madmen were we to chart a course that must run through and beyond that stronghold? But Long Shadow had enemies not as easily daunted as I. For some of those, no earthly fortress, nor even time itself, meant much. They would devour him, now or later, the moment his guard fell. He had chosen to play for the ultimate stakes in a game where the risks were as grim as the potential winnings were great. It was too late to get out. He would be victor or victim. Long Shadow lived inside the crystal chamber that topped Overlook's tallest central tower. He slept seldom for fear of the night. He spent hours and hours just staring southward at a plain of glittering stone. A screech ripped the air over the grim city. The people of Shadowcatch ignored it. If they thought about their master's strange ally at all, it was probably to hope that a fate would catch up and rob Long Shadow of this potent weapon. The inhabitants of Kialune were a broken people, spiritless, without hope, worse even, than the Jaikuri at their lowest ebb during the siege of the Jagore. Almost all of them were too young to recall a time when there was not a Shadow Master there exercising more power over their lives than had their lost gods. Even Long Shadow could not extirpate rumor. Even at the heart of his empire, some people had to travel, and travelers always carry tales. Some stories are even true. The people of Shadowcatch knew that a doom from the north was coming. The name of the Black Company lay at the heart of every rumor. That made no one happy. Long Shadow was the very devil, but many of his people feared his fall would be but the precursor to a far bleaker season. Man, woman, and child, the people of Shadowcatch were privy to the one true secret of the universe. There is always a darker shadow lurking beyond the one whose face you can see. Long Shadow reached out and inflicted pain and fear because he himself was the victim of a thousand terrors. It was ugly out there. So ugly, I wanted to go back somewhere where it was warm and there was someone to hold me and tell me that the dark was not always the lurking place of terror. I wanted my sari, my light in the night that rules the world. Smoke, take me home. Chapter 36. Croker did warn me. Be precise, he said. He warned me several times, in fact. I was ripped this way and dragged that, to and through the place of blood and burning, papers browning, blackening, curling in such slow motion. Blood pooled deep where I lay in my own vomit. The slap of running feet was like the slow, booming footfalls of giants. I heard screams that had no end. Croker warned me. I was thoughtless. What he did not tell me, or maybe did not understand, was that the concept home could, in one man's mind, become defined by emotional pain. Torn. Shredded. Smoke took me to Taglios, only for that minute in the real now that is like the end of all time. I reeled and flung away from there with such revulsion that I threw myself and the hateful shreds and the disoriented smoke all the way to hell. He had no will and no identity, so he could not and did not laugh as I floated down into the lake of pain. Hell has a name. Its name is Dejagore. But Dejagore is only hell's lesser face. From the greater hell I escaped. One more time. No identity and no will. The wind blows, but nothing moves in the place of glittering stone. Night falls. The wind dies. The plain yields up its heat as shadows waken. Moonlight settles upon the silence of stone. The plain runs east and west, north and south, without discernible bounds, viewed from within. Though its ends be uncertain, it had a definite center. That is, an epic structure built of the same stone as the pillars and plain. Within that fastness, nothing moves either, though at times mists of light shimmer as they leak over from beyond the gates of dream. Shadows linger in corners, and way down, inside the core of the place, in the feeblest throb of the heart of darkness, there is life of a sort. Chapter 37. No will.
No identity. Now, no smoke. Now, just pain. So much smoke drifted away. Now, just slavery to the memories. Now, at home, in the House of Pain.
Chapter 38.
There you are! So here we are again. You were missed.
Faceless thing that nevertheless seems to be smiling, pleased with itself.
It has been a night full of adventures, has it not? And the fun continues. Look, there! The Black Company and their auxiliaries have begun making life especially unpleasant for Shadowlanders, so bold as to have taken up residence inside Dejigore's wall. See how they use the doppelgangers and imaginary soldiers to lure the Southerners into deadly traps, to get them to betray themselves? Oh, and come back to the wall. This is a small thing, but it could become the stuff of epics. The fighting has all shifted to the east side of the city. Hardly anybody is over there now. A few men to watch from the ramparts is all. And some unenthusiastic Shadowlander scouts down there in the darkness, not really paying attention. Otherwise, how could they miss this spidery little figure rappelling down the outside of the wall? Why on earth would a 200-year-old fourth-rate sorcerer want to climb down a rope to go where very unfriendly little brown men might decide to dance on his head? The wounded stallion of mysterious sorceress breed has stopped screaming. At last, it's dead. Green misty stuff still rises from its death wound. The wound still glows at its edges. Out there? Yes. Look at them. Two very devils they are, aren't they? Cloaked in their pink mists. They don't seem to be coming to devour the city, though, do they? What is that? The Shadowlanders out there are scattering like the foxes in the henhouse. Their cries are filled with pure terror. Amongst them something dark moves swiftly. Look. It pulled a man down there, didn't it? There is so little light now that the focus of battle has shifted. The old man is as black as the heart of the night itself. Think any mortal eye will notice him sneaking around among the dead? Where is he headed? Shadow Spinner's dead horse? Who would expect that? It's the act of a madman. The creeping darkness is moving toward the dead horse, too. See how its eyes flash red when the fires in the city flare up? Look at that fool. Running toward it instead of away. There go his guts. Stupidity can be fatal. The little black man has vanished because he has stopped moving. There he is. He heard something. There he goes, trotting toward the dead stallion. He wants his spear back. And maybe that does make some crazy sense. He worked hard making it. He has stopped again, eye huge as he sniffs the night and catches an almost forgotten odor. At the same moment, the deadly darkness catches wind of him. A pantherine roar of triumph stills hearts all across the plain. The darkness begins moving faster and faster. The little black man grabs his spear and runs for the wall. Will he make it? Can two stubby ancient legs carry him there fast enough to escape the death racing toward him? The thing is huge, and it is filled with joy. The little man reaches the rope, but he is still 80 feet down from safety, and he is holed and winded. He whirls. His timing is perfect. The head of a spear reaches out just as the monster leaps. The beast twists in the air, evading the killing thrust, but taking a cruel wound from its snout back through its left ear.
It howls.
Green mist boils off its red glowing wound. The beast loses all interest in the old man, who begins his long climb to the ramparts. That bizarrely carved spear is slung across his back now, held there by a mundane length of cotton string. No one notices. No one cares. The fighting has gone elsewhere. Chapter 39. The southerners seem to have just closed their eyes and shoved their heads into a beehive, don't they?
What?
Why so reluctant?
Come see, this is amusing.
Everywhere you look, the southerners are falling back. Sometimes they're running, sometimes just slinking away through the shadows before death overhauls them. Look there. Shadow Spinner, the king enemy himself, all but crippled, paying no attention to anyone or anything but those two pink-limbed archetypes come out of the hills to devour him. And Mogaba. Watch him be the master tactician. Watch him be the ultimate warrior, exploiting the enemy's every weakness. Now that there is no chance to accomplish the deviltry that moved him earlier in the evening. See that? No southerner, however great his reputation, dares come near Mogaba. Even their great heroes are like novice children when he steps forward himself. He is way bigger than life, this Mogaba. He is the triumphant centerpiece of his own imagined saga. Something has gone out of the southerners. They wanted to conquer. They knew they had to conquer because their master Shadow Spinner would not tolerate anything less. He has a particular lack of understanding when it comes to failure. His followers are established solidly inside the city. Mild stubbornness will give them success. But they're on the run. Something has grabbed hold of them and convinced them that it is not possible for even their souls to survive if they stay inside Dejigori. Chapter 40.
You all right, Mergen?
I shook my head. I felt like a kid who had spun around about 20 times, intentionally trying to make himself dizzy before jumping into some silly competition. I was in an alley. Runtboy Goblin was beside me, looking extremely concerned. I'm fine, I told him. Then I fell to my knees, stuck my hands out to grab the alley walls so I would not spin around anymore. I insisted, I'm all right.
Of course you are. Candles. Keep an eye on this dork. He tries to take over, get deaf. He's got too tender a heart.
I tried not to let my ego become engaged. Maybe I was too tender, too much of a sucker. The world sure isn't kind to the man who tries to be gentle and thoughtful. Its spin slowed down till I no longer had to hold on. A scuffle broke out behind us. Someone cursed in a nasal liquid tongue. Somebody else growled.
This asshole is fast! Whoa, whoa, whoa! I yelled. Let the man alone! Let him come up here!
Candles didn't knock me over the head or contradict me. The short, wide Nguyen Bao guy, who had shown me to Ki Dam's hideout, marched up to me. The fingers of his right hand rubbed his right cheek. He seemed utterly astonished that somebody had laid a hand on him. His ego suffered again when he spoke in Nguyen Bao, and I said, "Sorry, old-timer. No speaky. Gonna got to be Taglian or Grogor with me." In Grogor, which my maternal grandmother spoke because Grandpa captured her from those people, I asked, "What's happening?"
I knew maybe 20 words in Grogor. But that was 20 more than anyone else within 7,000 miles.
The speaker sends me to lead you to where the invader is most vulnerable. We have watched closely and know.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Lead on. Shifting languages, I observed.
Marvelous how these guys suddenly talk the lingo when they want something.
Candles grunted. Goblin, who had sneaked forward for a look around, returned just in time to offer me directions to the same weak point Nanyuang Bao had in mind. The squat man seemed a little surprised we could find our butts with our hands, maybe even a touch disgruntled.
You got a name short and wide? I asked.
If you don't have one you prefer, I guarantee you, these guys will hang one on you and I promise you won't like it.
Here, here.
Goblin agreed, chuckling.
I am Doge. All Nguyen Bao call me Uncle Doge.
All right, Uncle. You going up there with us? Or did you just come over to direct traffic? Already Goblin was whispering instructions to the guys creeping up behind us. No doubt, he had left a few soft spells of sleepiness or confusion amongst the southerners as he was scouting. Little discussion was needed. We would drive into their soft spot, kill anything that moved, split them in half, butcher anybody who didn't run away. Then we would back away before Mogaba began feeling too confident.
I will accompany you, although that stretches the speaker's instructions to extremes. You bone warriors surprise us continually. I wish to watch you at your work.
I never considered killing people to be my profession, but did not care to argue. You speak Taglian very well, Uncle. He smiled.
I am forgetful, though, Stone Soldier. I may not remember a word after tonight.
Unless the speaker jogged his memory, I supposed. Uncle Doge did a great deal more than watch us hack and stab southerners. He turned into a one-man cyclone, flailing around with a lightning sword. He was as sudden as the lightning, but as graceful as a dancer. Each time he moved, another Shadowlander fell.
Damn. I told Goblin a while later.
Remind me not to get into a quarrel with that character.
I'll remind you to bring a crossbow and let him have it in the back from 30 feet is what I'll do. After I put a deafness and a stupidity spell on him, to even things up a little.
Don't be surprised if it's me distracting you someday, when One Eye sneaks up and offers you a cactus suppository.
Speaking of the runt, tell me, who's being conspicuously absent without leave lately?
I sent messages to the various units suggesting that we had done our part to relieve Mogava's troops. We should all go back to our part of town, patch ourselves up, take naps, like that. I told the Nguyen Bao elder, Uncle Doge, please inform the speaker that the Black Company extends its gratitude and friendship. Tell him he is free to call upon that at any time. We will extend ourselves as much as possible. The short white man bowed far enough that his movement had to mean something. I bowed back, almost as deeply. That must have been the right move, because he smiled slightly, bowed shallowly for himself, hustled off.
Runs like a duck,
Candles observed.
I'm glad that duck was on our side, though.
You can say that again.
I'm glad that duck...
Ah!
Candles had me by the throat.
Somebody help me shut him up!
That was just the start of what became a wild night of blowing off tensions. I got no chance to participate myself, but I heard it was a banner night
for the Jaikuri horse. Chapter 41.
Where the hell have you been? I snarled at One Eye. The company just fought through its nastiest episode in, just days, and you were obviously absent every stinking second.
Not that his presence would have made any difference. One Eye grinned. My displeasure did not bother him a bit. He had outlived or outstubborned a parade of snot noses like me.
Shit, kid. I had to get my Shadow Master sticker back, didn't I? I've got a lot of work in that thing. What's the matter?
Huh? For a moment I saw a little black louse scuttling across a gray landscape from a height unattainable anywhere in Dejigore, even atop the Citadel, where old crew guys were not welcome anymore. Never mind, Runt. I'd like to kick your ass, but it wouldn't do any good now.
So you were out there? What became of Widowmaker and Lifetaker?
While I was arranging a quieter life for our leader, those two vanished without a trace. I wonder how Mogapa would write all this if he was keeping the annals.
One Eye. What?
Now he sounded irritated. You want to answer me? What happened to Widowmaker and Lifetaker?
You know something, kid? I don't have the faintest freaking idea. And I don't care. I only had one thing on my mind. I wanted my spear back so I could use it next time that sucker ain't looking.
Then I had to worry about dodging a gang of raggedy-ass Shadowlanders who tried to jump me. They went away somewhere, all right?
And none of us could fathom that. Because they vanished just when the Shadowlander confidence was rockiest. Shadow Spinner had his tail between his legs, and his boys could have been broken. I grumbled. If that was the old man and lady, they would have kept coming till they broke the whole show wide open, wouldn't they? I glared at an albino crow perched not 20 feet away. Its head was cocked. It stared at me with malign intelligence. There were a lot of crows tonight. Other agendas were being pursued. I was just one pawn, caught up in tides of intrigue. But if we were careful, the company need not get swept away. Mogaba and the Gnar and their Taglian troop stayed busy for days. Maybe the Shadow Masters decided to make Mogaba pay for his failure to fulfill his end of the implicit bargain. Which was just one more example of the way people down here go bugfuck when they're involved with a black company. It could make a guy nervous if he thought about everybody within 1,000 miles seeming to wish he'd never been born. My guys enjoyed Mogaba's situation, and he could not squawk about their attitudes. We gave him exactly what he asked. We saved his ass and set him up so all he had to do was chase a few Shadowlanders out of town. I had to see him almost every day at staff meetings. Again and again, we showed ourselves to the soldiers, pretending to be brothers marching shoulder to shoulder against our evil foe. Not once was anybody fooled, except, maybe, Mogaba. I never took it personal. I took a stance I believed the analysts of the past would approve. Just picturing Mogaba as not one of us.
We are the Black Company. We have no friends. All others are the enemy, or at best, not to be trusted. That relationship with the world does not require hatred or any other emotion. It requires wariness.
Perhaps our refusal to remonstrate, or even to acknowledge Mugabe's treachery, was the final straw. Or perhaps the backbreaker was his awareness that even his Nar compatriots now believed the real captain might still live. Whatever. The ultimate and perfect warrior drifted across a boundary from beyond, which he could not return. And we did not discover the truth until we had paid in treasures of pain. It took 10 days for Dejagore to return to normal, if normal was our state before the great attack. Both sides had suffered terribly. I believed Shadow Spinner would now just lick his wounds and let us get hungry for a while. Chapter 42.
Got something for you, kid.
I started awake.
What? What happened? I don't drift off that way.
One eye had a big, shit-eating grin on, but it evaporated when he looked at me closer. He darted in, grabbed my chin, turned my head right and left.
You just have one of your spells?
Spells?
You know what I mean.
Not exactly. I just had their word for the fact that I went spooky sometimes.
You've got a kind of psychic shimmer. Maybe I caught you just in time.
He and Goblin kept talking about doing experiments to find out what is happening, but there never seemed to be time to actually do anything. What do you have?
The work parties broke into the old catacombs this morning,
Longo told me.
Everybody's charging around in there all excited.
I can imagine. Find any treasure yet? One Eye looked put upon. For such a black-hearted toad, he can manage a truly impressive show of self-righteous injury. I take it not.
We found some books, a whole pile, all sealed up neat and everything. Looks like they've been there since the Shadow Masters first came.
Makes sense, since they always burned the books and the priests. You find any priests lurking down there?
Not hardly.
Look, I gotta get back. Before somebody grabbed the treasure out from under him, no doubt.
I got a couple guys lugging them books up for you.
Gods forfend, you should have lifted anything yourself.
You got a serious attitude problem, kid. I'm an old man.
One Eye did a fade. He has that knack when he's about to find himself in an indefensible position. A city seldom is buttoned up so tight that no news gets in from outside. Sometimes it seems almost mystical, but the word does come through. In Dejagore, rumor seldom brought in anything Mugabe wanted to hear. I was studying the discovered books, so intrigued I was letting duty slide. They were written in Jaikuri, but the written form thereof is almost identical to written Taglian. Goblin stepped in.
You doing all right? No more dizziness?
No. You guys worry too much.
No, we don't. Look, some new rumors are going around. There's supposedly a relief column headed our way. Blade, of all people, is in charge.
Blade? He isn't. He's never run anything bigger than a reduced company. Before we ever got here. Fighting guerrilla style against amateurs.
I don't make them up. I just report them. He did do well.
So did Willow Swan and Cordy Mather. But that was accident and luck, and Shadowlander stupidity more than anything those three actually did.
Why on earth is he commanding an army? He's supposedly Lady's second in command. Not much doubt anymore that she survived.
She's also pissed off and putting together a new army.
Bet Mugabe's jumping for joy, running around hollering, "We're saved, we're saved."
You might say he's jumping.
Over the following few days, we heard 1,000 wild stories. If a tenth were true, some really bizarre changes were underway out there in the world.
You heard the latest?
Goblin asked me one night when I took a rare break from the books to examine that outer world from the wall.
Lady ain't lady after all. She's the incarnation of some goddess named Kina. A real badass, too, apparently.
She would be. Tide, you know Kina, don't you? Tell us about her. Tide wasn't allowed into our warrens, but he always turned up whenever I came up for air. He forgot all three words of Taglian he had admitted to knowing. The name of that goddess scrubbed his brain clean. I said, "That's what happens when you mention Kina to any of these people. I can't even get our prisoners to talk about her. You would think she belonged to the Black Company."
"Must be a real charmer,"
Bucket opined. "Oh, she is, she is. There's one." I meant a shooting star. We were keeping count, also of enemy watchfires. The Southerners had scattered in small unit encampments around the plain recently. I guess they were afraid we might sneak away.
"You know something about her, then?"
Goblin asked. "From those books you guys found." The men were bitter. The books and some sealed jars filled with grain were the only treasures they unearthed. The Guni were the majority religion in Jaikur, and the Guni do not bury their dead. They burn them. The minority Vedna do bury their dead, but do not include any grave goods. Where their dead are bound, they have no need of luggage. In paradise, everything is provided. In hell, too. One was a compilation of Guni myths, in variants from all over. The guy who recorded them was a religious scholar. His book wasn't meant to get out where it might confuse ordinary people.
"I'm confused, and there ain't nothing ordinary about me,"
Bucket observed.
"So what's the scoop, Mergen? How come they won't tell us about this bitch? Whoa! Did you see that one? It exploded!"
"All right," I told them. "The Guni religion is the most common one around here."
"I think we know that, Mergen,"
Goblin said. "Just making the point. Most people down here believe in Kina. Even if they're not Guni, they believe. Here's the story. The Guni have lords of light and lords of darkness. They've been doing their lording since the beginning of time."
"Sounds like standard stuff."
"It is. Only the value systems are different from what we knew back home. The balance between darkness and light is more dynamic here, and isn't weighted the same emotionally as our struggle between good and evil. Moreover, Kina is a sort of self-elevated outside agency of decay and corruption that attacks both darkness and light. She was created by the Lords of Light to help defeat a horde of really nasty demons they couldn't handle any other way. She helped by eating the demons. Naturally, she got fat, and apparently wanted dessert, because she tried to eat everybody else, too."
"She was stronger than the gods who created her?"
"Guys, I didn't make this stuff up. Don't ask me to rationalize it. Goblin, you've been everywhere. You ever seen a religion that can't be picked to shreds by any non-believer with brains enough to tie his own bootlaces?" Goblin shrugged.
"You're as cynical as Croker was."
"Yeah, good for me. Anyway, there's a lot of typically murky mythological stuff about mothers and fathers and vicious, hideous, probably incestuous carryings-on among the other gods, while Kina kept getting stronger. She was real sneaky. That's one of her attributes. Deceit. But then, her main creator, or father, tricked her and put a sleep spell on her. She's still snoring away somewhere, but she can touch our world through her dreams. She's got her worshippers. All Guni deities do. Big, little, good, bad, indifferent. They all have their temples and priesthoods. I can't find out much about Kina's followers. They're called deceivers. The soldiers won't talk about them. They flat refuse, like naming Kina might actually waken her. Which, I gather, is the holy mission of her worshippers.
Too weird for me, Bucket grumbled.
Goblin said, That explains why Lady scares the shit out of everybody whenever she dresses up. If they really think she's turned into this goddess.
I figure we should find out everything we can about this Kina.
Crack plan, Mergen. How? If nobody will talk.
Yeah. Even the boldest Taglians threatened to get the vapors if I pressed. It was obvious that they were not just terrified of this goddess. They were scared of me, too.
One Eye brought heartening news.
This stuff about the relief force is gold, boss. Every night now, Spinner is sneaking troops out through the hills like he don't think we can see them go if it's dark.
Could he be giving up the siege?
The troops are all headed north. Home ain't north.
I did not offer another alternative. One Eye would not have come if he was not sure. Of course, One Eye being sure never meant that One Eye was right. He was One Eye. I thanked him, sent him to do a small chore, found Goblin, and asked him what he thought. The little wizard seemed surprised I would bother.
Did One Eye stutter or something?
No, but he's One Eye. Goblin could not contain his big frog grin. That made perfect sense to him. Nobody relayed the news to Mogaba. I thought it would go easier for everybody if he didn't know. But Mogaba heard rumors, too. Dejigore was a nightmare town, filled with factions only loosely united in defiance of the besiegers. Mogaba's forces were the strongest. The Jaikuri were most numerous. We old crew, with our auxiliaries, were less numerous and less powerful. But boy, were we strong in our righteousness. And then there were the Nguyen Bao. The Nguyen Bao remained an enigma. Chapter 43. Kidam's family occupied the same dismal, filthy, smoky, pungent hole until the deluge drove them out. The perquisites of power did not appeal to